It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So, you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So, whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Igor was a dreamer. He looked at the world in terms of the future, of that next horizon, of what comes next. He was born into a family of engineers in Russia back in 1936. He grew up dreaming of electronics, of wires and circuits and electricity. But Igor's dreams weren't only about making things. Igor also dreamed of mountains. He loved the outdoors, and when he wasn't tinkering with his gadgets, he was often out hiking in the woods. Igor dreamed of new frontiers and, like so many explorers who had come before him, he dreamed of the possibilities to be found by the unknown. From an early age, Igor's future was pretty much laid out for him. Since he came from an engineering family, he would eventually grow up to attend one of the leading technical universities in the entire Soviet Union, the Ural Polytechnic Institute in Sverdlovsk, or UPI for short. In 1957, the Soviet Union shocked the world when it launched Sputnik, the first man-made satellite to orbit the Earth. It was while Igor was attending UPI that he built his own telescope so that he and his friends could watch the low-orbit objects streak by in the night sky. The 1950s were a time of optimism in the Soviet Union. Nikita Khrushchev had begun what is known as the Thaw. This was a period throughout the decade following the death of Joseph Stalin, in which repression and censorship across the USSR began to relax under Khrushchev's leadership. To many young people living in the Soviet Union, this era felt like a new beginning, a time of great prosperity when the great Soviet machine was on the rise, and the possibilities of life were endless. Igor and his friends got swept up in all that fresh optimism. He was geared up and ready for that future he dreamed of, and he was always looking for his next challenge. As a seasoned hiker, Igor often ventured out into the wilderness using equipment that he had invented or improved upon himself. It was this bold-faced confidence he exhibited that also made him a natural leader. Others often gravitated toward him. By the time he was 23 years old, Igor had gained a reputation as the person you most wanted to lead you out into the wilderness. In late 1958, Igor began planning a challenging winter expedition that would epitomize the ambitious new attitude that had swept through the Soviet Union. A 16-day cross-country ski trip through the Ural Mountains, across the north-south mountain range that divided Russia from Siberia. This was going to be a pivotal trip for Igor and his friends. They were all grade 2 members of the school's hiking club. But once they completed this challenging trek into the mountains, they would return to earn their Grade 3 certificates, the highest such certification in the country. But in order to achieve the certification, there were a number of difficult requirements the group first had to meet. The group needed to cover at least 300 kilometers on foot, with a third of that trip across difficult terrain. The minimum duration of such a trek had to be 16 days, with no fewer than 8 of those days through uninhabited regions, and at least 6 days spent sleeping in a tent. It was a difficult challenge, but once the group earned their certificates, that meant they would now be qualified to teach others as masters of sport. This was something Igor and his friends wanted badly. Igor came up with a proposal he submitted to the UPI Sports Club. This trip would take himself and a group of 9 friends into an area of wilderness 350 miles north of Sverdlovsk. This was the territory of the indigenous Mansi people. The Mansi were a tribe of semi-nomadic hunters and fishermen. who had occupied the frigid landscape throughout the Ural Mountains for centuries. The Manzi first came into contact with Russia back around the 16th century. Since then, they had both assimilated with Russia, yet still maintained much of their independence, living off the land and mostly keeping to themselves. Igor and his friends planned on skiing 200 miles across a route that, as far as anyone knew, no Russian had ever attempted before. Although much of their journey would be across relatively gentle slopes that rose up out of a vast boreal forest, the real challenge would be surviving the brutally frigid temperatures and deep snow. Igor would go on to gather 9 others to join him on his cross-country trip into the Siberian wilderness. Partway through the trip, one of those friends, Yuri Yudin, became injured and was unable to keep going with the rest of the group. It turns out, he was the lucky one. Before departing, Igor agreed to send a telegram to their sports club as soon as the group returned to Vizhai, the nearest human settlement, which lay about 50 miles south of their destination. Igor expected that this would occur no later than February 12, 1959. Although by February 20th, when no word had come from the group of hikers, many of their relatives began demanding a rescue operation. On February 26th, a search and rescue team was sent out and would eventually discover the group's campsite. And that's where things began to get troubling. Their tent was found partially buried under the snow, and it appeared that it had been ripped open from the inside. At first, there were no signs of where the group of hikers had gone. Inside the tent, most of the group's protective clothing and other survival gear was left behind. There were tracks leading away from the tent, but these just raised more questions, because most of these tracks had been made by several people walking through the deep snow in their socks, or even with bare feet. These tracks would eventually lead to the first of the bodies being discovered. The first two hikers were discovered next to an extinguished campfire. They were nearly naked and frozen to death. Over time, the others would also be found dead as well. Their remains only raised even more questions. Several of the hikers had suffered a series of horrific injuries. Some of the hikers suffered broken bones and massive internal injuries that were described by the medical examiner as being similar to that of being struck by a car. A couple of the hikers were missing their eyes. One of the women was missing her tongue. What happened to those 9 hikers is considered by many to be the greatest unsolved mystery in Russian history. Later on, the area near where the hikers' bodies were found would be renamed after the group's leader, Igor Dyatlov. And although the secrets of Dyatlov Pass have endured for more than 60 years, recently some researchers think they may finally have solved the mystery. I'm Nate Hale, currently trying to teach a cave full of atomic yetis to become my podcasting interns, and this is The Conspirators. With all that's been written and said about the mystery behind the death of the 9 hikers at Dyatlov Pass, it can be easy to overlook the fact that these were 9 real people, each with lives and dreams and futures of their own. Like Igor Dyatlov, Zinaida Kolmogorova, or Zina to her friends, was a student of radio engineering, although the subject didn't come to her quite as naturally. She was widely regarded as being fun and engaging. It seemed like everyone had a crush on her, including Igor. He kept her picture in his jacket pocket, close to his heart, although the feeling wasn't mutual. Zina briefly dated one of the other group members, Yuri Doroshenko, but it appears that by the time the group departed on their ill-fated trip, Zina and Doroshenko had cooled things off and were choosing to remain friends. One of the first people Igor Dyatlov recruited for the trip was his close friend, Georgi Krivonoshenko. He had graduated from UPI 2 years earlier, and he now worked as an engineer at the Mayak nuclear complex in what was then the secret town of Chelyabinsk. Georgi was always the life of the party. He was the joker of the group, one who liked to sing and entertain everyone with his mandolin. Igor also invited 2 other recent graduates, Rustem Slobodin and Nikolai Thibault Brignol. Thibault was of French descent, and his father had nearly been worked to death in one of Stalin's gulags. Slobodin came from a wealthy family of affluent university professors, but he wasn't stuffy at all. He was likable and down to earth. Yuri Uden would become the only member of the group who survived. That's because he suffered constant problems with rheumatism, heart problems, and chronic knee and back pain, all of which ironically saved his life. Alexander Kolevatov was studying nuclear physics. He was very analytical in his thinking and intensely private. Although the group would go on to document much of their trip in their journals, Kolevatov was the most reluctant to share what he wrote with the others. At 20 years old, the youngest of the group was Lyudmila Dubinina, who went by Lyuda. She was an economics major, a track star, and an ardent communist. She had proven herself capable of enduring intense pain and discomfort. On a previous hiking trip, she was accidentally shot in the leg by one of her companions. Even though she had to be carried over 50 miles of rugged terrain, Lyuda remained in good spirits throughout the journey. Just before they were set to depart, Igor surprised them all by adding a 10th member to their party, one who stood out for a number of reasons. Semyon Zolotaryov wasn't a UPI student, for one thing. He was also much older than everyone else. The man was 37 years old, a veteran of the Second World War. He had an old-fashioned mustache, a mouthful of metal teeth, and multiple tattoos. All the others were surprised when they gathered at the train station and Igor introduced him. He explained that Zolotaryov was a local hiking instructor who would be a valuable addition to the team. Zolotaryov told the others that he had originally planned on heading out with another group of student hikers, but when their timetable didn't work out with Zolotaryov, he asked if he could join Igor Dyatlov's group instead. They left Sverdlovsk by train on January 23rd. Since some members of the group were dirt poor, the ones without any money hid beneath the train seats to avoid paying for a ticket. Although at first there was some natural discomfort among the group towards Zolotaryov, once the group was settled into their train car, Georgi broke out his mandolin and began to play. The entire group, including Zolotaryov, began to laugh and sing along, and soon it was like they were all old friends. Later on, Krivanoshenko was arrested by police for playing his mandolin and pretending to panhandle in a train station. The others had to beg the officers to let him go. We actually know quite a bit about what the group did early on throughout much of their trip. At least five of them had cameras with them, and afterwards there were plenty of photos and journal entries left behind that documented their journey. After 2 days aboard the train, the group reached the town of Ivdel, one of Stalin's notorious gulags. From there, the group traveled on by bus. They then hitched a ride on the back of a woodcutter's truck, eventually turning to both skis and horse-drawn sleigh to continue traveling onward. They made their way to an abandoned logging camp called Second Northern. It was there when Yuri Uden began to complain about his sciatica, which forced him to drop out of the trip. On January 28th, Uden turned back while the other nine hikers carried on towards Mount Ortorten. From there, the weather kept getting worse and worse as they climbed higher into the mountains. Harsh winds, heavy snow, and sub-zero temperatures slowed their journey. By February 2nd, Igor Dyatlov and his friends realized they had somehow drifted off course. They found themselves further west than they'd expected to be. They'd accidentally ended up along the northern slope of the mountain the Mansi called, ominously enough, Kolatsiakol, the Dead Mountain. But this didn't worry them. It was still just a minor setback, so they pressed on. But because they were now all off course, the group was forced to set up camp along an empty mountain slope. Here they would be exposed to the elements with only their tent to protect them throughout the night. Temperatures outside dropped to as low as minus 25 degrees Fahrenheit. The original plan was for the group to climb Mount Ortorten, then turn around and head back to the village of Vizhai around February 12th. There they would send back a telegram to the UPI Sports Club, letting them know they had arrived safely. But that telegram was never sent. At first, the sports club wasn't too concerned. They knew the group was well-trained in how to survive in the wilderness. They also knew the territory they were headed into was remote, and there were any number of factors that could have delayed them. But after several days, the hikers' families began to get worried. They started phoning the university as well as the local bureau of the Communist Party demanding action be taken. So on February 20th, a search party was finally sent out. The searchers included a number of student volunteers from the university, several prison guards from Ivdel, as well as a number of Mansi hunters, military personnel, and local police. Planes and helicopters were also deployed to the area. On February 25th, some of the students found ski tracks leading toward the mountains. The following day, the hiker's tent was found in a relatively flat area just above the tree line alongside the dead mountain. Now, as ominous as that name may sound, the Monsley actually called it that because there was no wild game to be found there. The group's tent was just the first of many clues that pointed to the hiker suffering a terrible fate. It was discovered partially collapsed and buried in a thin layer of snow. The tent appeared to have been deliberately cut open from the inside. All the hiker's gear was still inside, though. Their boots, coats, and other equipment were still in there, neatly arranged. There was also food laid out as if they had been interrupted in the middle of preparing a meal. Wood was stacked up for the portable stove, and all the rest of their cameras, journals, and other gear were left behind. About 100 feet away from the tent, the search team discovered several sets of footprints leading downhill towards the tree line away from the tent. You could tell a couple things from these prints. One, based on how evenly spaced they were, the people who made them were walking calmly, not running. And two, that nearly everyone who made them were barefoot or only wearing socks in the snow. One of them appeared to be wearing a single ski boot. The searchers were able to follow these tracks for another 600 or 700 yards before they disappeared into the tree line. Then the following day, the searchers found the first of the bodies. These were the remains of Georgi Krivonoshenko and Yuri Doroshenko. They were discovered lying under a tall cedar tree at the edge of the woods, next to the remnants of an extinguished campfire. Each of the men were nearly naked, only dressed in their underwear. Approximately 12 to 15 feet up the tree were several broken branches, upon which were discovered bits of torn skin and shredded clothing. Some investigators suggested that one of the men may have attempted to climb the tree, perhaps to look for the others. Although some people have gone so far as to suggest that perhaps something chased him up the tree. Something very large and very powerful. Not long after the first two corpses were discovered, searchers found the bodies of Igor Dyalov and Zina Kolmogorova. Both of them were farther up the slope, and they were faced in the direction of the tent, which has led many researchers into the mystery to believe that they may have been headed back there. Slobodin's body was discovered a few days later. He was lying on the slope leading toward the tent as well. He was wearing a sock on one foot and a felt bootie on the other. Something had fractured his skull. For several weeks, those were the only members of the hiking group they found. Although the medical examiner would ultimately rule their cause of death as hypothermia, he also noted a number of strange details. Krivonoshenko had blackened fingers and third-degree burns on his shin and foot. Inside his mouth was a chunk of flesh he had bitten off his own right hand. Doroshenko's body also showed a number of burns as well as a charred sock. All the bodies had a number of cuts and abrasions on their skin. All of this was mysterious enough that it prompted a homicide investigation led by a prosecutor named Lev Ivanov. Investigators took numerous photos of the scene, detailed maps were drawn, and other forensic evidence was gathered. After the tent was brought back to a police station, a local seamstress who had stopped by to work on some of the officers' uniforms observed that the tent had been deliberately cut from the inside. Whatever happened that night had been frightening enough that it caused these 9 experienced hikers to cut their way out of their tent and flee mostly naked into sub-zero temperatures in the middle of a blizzard at night. It would take another 2 months before the remaining 4 hikers were found by a Monsey hunter and his dog. Their remains would raise even more disturbing questions. All of these hikers were better clothed than the others, and they didn't die of hypothermia. The bodies were discovered buried near a makeshift den that had been constructed in a hole dug out of the snow and lined with tree branches. Several items of tattered clothing were found scattered about. Among these were a pair of cotton sweatpants with the right leg cut off, and half of a woman's sweater. The remaining hikers were discovered lying together in a rocky stream bed buried beneath 13 feet of snow. Thibaut's skull was caved in on one side so severely that pieces of bone were driven into his brain. Dubonina and Zolotaryov both suffered from massive chest injuries. Both of them had multiple broken ribs. Zolotaryov and Dubonina were both found face down in the creek, and both of them were missing their eyes. Dubonina was also missing part of her upper lip and her tongue. If that's not bizarre enough, an examination of the clothing that had been worn by some of these victims exhibited unusually high levels of radiation. A radiation expert brought in to examine the clothing testified that he believed the levels may have been even higher than they registered, but some of the radiation had been washed away by the running water. Then on May 28th, the investigation into the hikers' deaths was abruptly closed. Lev Ivanov, the prosecutor in charge of the investigation, wrote a report that concluded homicide was not a factor, and that the cause of the hiker's demise was an overwhelming force which they were not able to overcome. Soon after, in true Soviet fashion, a number of officials were either punished or fired. This included the director of the UPI, the chairman of the sports club, and the local Communist Party secretary. All the evidence that had been gathered in the investigation was collected by the Soviet government and classified. After that, the area surrounding the Dead Mountain was marked off limits. The tent remained in storage for several years before it was finally thrown out after it became moldy. Eventually, the area in the mountains the hikers never reached would be renamed Dyatlov Pass, after the group's leader. Throughout all that time, the victims' families never gave up hoping for answers. Many of them wrote to Khrushchev asking for help, but no help came. Eventually, the case would begin to fade from memory. It wouldn't be until the Glasnost era of the 1980s and 90s when the mystery would resurface once again. In 1990, Lev Ivanov, the now retired prosecutor in charge of the investigation, published an article in which he stated that the Soviet government had pressured him to close the investigation. This article revealed a number of other bizarre details never before released to the public. The article stated that the hikers may have been killed by mysterious heat rays, and that strange lights had been spotted in the skies over the Ural Mountains at the time the hikers died. Ivanov claimed that during his investigation, he had found trees with unusual burn marks. The last photograph on Krivonoshenko's camera shows a blurry image of what appears to be bright lights against a dark background. After these revelations came out, the Dyatlov Pass incident became known as the single biggest unsolved mystery in Russian history. Hundreds of books, documentaries, and websites have been devoted to solving the mystery.
Hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas, plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
In the year 2000, family and friends of the victims established the Dyatlov Group Memorial Foundation, dedicated to preserving the memories of the deceased hikers. The group's president, Yurat Kuntsevich, was 12 years old when he attended the funerals of some of the victims. He grew up to teach at UPI, which was later renamed the Ural State Technical University. He led tours to the Dyatlov Pass all the way into his 70s. Since 1959, there have been at least 75 theories put forth about what really happened. These range from the supernatural, to murder, to all sorts of natural accidents. The problem is, very few of these theories actually fit all the known evidence, whereas it's certainly entertaining to think that UFOs or even a radioactive Yeti may have been responsible for what happened. There's very little evidence to support either of these things. There is an infamous photo discovered at the end of the roll on Tebow's camera of a shadowy figure that some people have suggested might be an actual photo of a Yeti stalking the group. In fact, this theory gained enough traction that the Discovery Channel did their own documentary on the Dyatlov Pass incident called Russian Yeti. But all you have to do is look at the other photos taken on the same roll of film before that shot to realize it's likely just another photo of one of the hikers taken while they were all clowning around in the snow. The unusually high radiation discovered in some of the hikers' bodies is often cited as evidence they may have been murdered by aliens. But once again, there's a much more down-to-earth explanation for this as well. You may recall that I mentioned Krivonoshenko worked at the Mayak nuclear power facility. Well, it turns out that in 1957, Mayak was the site of the third worst nuclear accident in history, coming in just after Chernobyl and Fukushima. An improperly stored underground nuclear waste tank exploded, contaminating thousands of kilometers of land. Krivonoshenko was part of the cleanup crew. Zina Kolmogorova came from one of the villages that was contaminated by the radiation from the accident. Therefore, it's conceivable that one or both of them might have brought with them some clothing or other items that were contaminated with radiation. Yet another possibility points out that the lanterns they used inside the tent contained a small amount of thorium, a radioactive isotope. Radiation is also at the heart of several other theories surrounding the deaths of the nine hikers. In 2008, a 3-foot-long piece of metal was found in the area that the Dyatlov Foundation believes is part of a Soviet ballistic missile. Soviet weapons testing in the area is something else that could account for the radiation found on the bodies. Likewise, it's also been suggested that perhaps the group encountered some Soviet military personnel who forced them out of their tent at gunpoint. This would explain why the footprints leading away from the tent were so orderly. Yet if that were the case, why were there no other footprints other than that of the hikers found? Nonetheless, it has long been suggested that there was some sort of Soviet-era cover-up going on in the deaths of nine hikers. One book on Dyatlov Pass published in Russia suggests that Zolotaryov and two of the other skiers were actually KGB agents, assigned to meet with a group of CIA agents in order to provide them with disinformation. If you recall, Zolotaryov was a stranger to the group who showed up at the last minute. He was also a former soldier who had ties to Soviet intelligence operations, or in other words, a prime candidate to be a covert KGB agent. In this version of events, Zolotaryov and a couple of the others were actually planted into the group of hikers in order to meet with the CIA to deliver phony evidence about Soviet nuclear research. But the CIA agents uncovered the deception and murdered everyone. There is yet another theory built around the idea of a Soviet cover-up that actually manages to check off most of the boxes. This comes to us from the book 1079, The Overwhelming Force of Dyatlov Pass by Teodora Hajiska. She is considered to be one of the world's leading experts on Dyatlov Pass, and she has developed a theory that suggests a mix of an accident followed by the Soviet's totalitarian government attempting to cover up a tragic mistake. She points out the fact that the tent the hikers used was actually built to be supported by stringing it up between two trees, not set up on a barren slope like the one where it was found. Both Igor Dyatlov and Semyon Zolotaryov were experienced hikers who would have known better than to set up a tent in such an exposed location as where it was found. In this scenario, Igor Dyatlov would have directed the group to set up camp inside the tree line, while the location the tent was originally found was actually the location where they set up a cache of extra supplies known as a labaz. Back inside the forest, one of the hikers would have climbed a tree and cut down some of the overhanging branches. This would explain why some branches were missing, as well as why bits of flesh were found high up in the tree next to the location where Krivonoshenko and Doroshenko's bodies were found. Hajiska believes that at the same time the nine hikers were settling in for the night, unbeknownst to them, there was something else going on that would lead to their deaths. Back in the 1950s, Russian geologists sometimes worked on weekends to do aerial surveys of the mountains searching for uranium deposits to be used in Soviet nuclear weapons. In order to do this, these geologists sometimes detonated 5-kilogram anti-magnetic, anti-tank blasts in mid-air to dislodge any uranium deposits in the earth below. As evidence of this, the book points out that Lev Ivanov, the former prosecutor in charge of the investigation, reported that both the Mansi people and another group of hikers in the area all reported seeing strange glowing orange orbs in the sky at the same time the hikers went missing. Ivanov was convinced these orbs were related to the deaths of the hikers, also noting that he had found strange burn marks high up in the tree line. If we assume these weren't alien spaceships, then perhaps they were some sort of floating Soviet incendiary bombs, like the ones that were used to locate uranium deposits. Hajiska believes these geologists dropped a series of bombs over the forest where Igor Dyatlov and the other hikers slept, the force of which caused a massive tree branch to fall on the hikers' tent, crushing them beneath its weight. According to this theory, the branch would have likely crushed Doroshenko and Krivonoshenko to death first, and caused many of the injuries seen in the other hikers. The remaining hikers who were able to get free suddenly found themselves in a terrible predicament. They were mostly unclothed because they were getting ready to go to sleep. Now, with their tent underneath a massive tree branch they were unable to move, they were forced to strip clothing away from their fallen comrades in order to survive. Igor Dyatlov, Zina Komolgorova, and Rustem Slobodin tried making their way uphill toward the cache of supplies they had left on the slope. Meanwhile, the others made their way further downhill where they attempted to dig a shelter in the snow. In Hajiska's theory, Dyatlov, Komolgorova, and Slobodin succumbed to hypothermia on their way to the supply cache. Meanwhile, the remaining hikers made their way further downhill where they attempted to dig out a traditional shelter in the snow, but eventually fell prey to the elements as well. The missing eyes and tongue could be explained away by either animal predation or natural decomposition. According to this theory, when all was said and done, after the Soviet government realized the terrible mistake their own geologists had committed, orders were immediately sent down to cover everything up. This was something that could be seen time and again throughout the history of the Soviet Union, where mistakes weren't tolerated, and in order to maintain a veneer of communist supremacy, cover-ups were common. Hajiska believes the Soviet authorities staged the scene by switching the location of the hiker's tent with that of the supply cache, as well as changing the locations of the bodies and tampering with other evidence. It's certainly an intriguing theory that does manage to cover most of the bases. The one big problem with this theory, though, is that it would have required a lot of work by a number of individuals to stage the scene. And yet there is little physical evidence showing any such operation occurred. For one thing, there should have been a number of other tracks in the snow showing that the Soviet military or someone else was present on the mountain other than the nine hikers. And yet, all that were found were the hikers' footprints. This leads us to the possibility that some sort of natural phenomena caused the tragic deaths. It's long been speculated that an avalanche may have been what killed the hikers. In this theory, an avalanche would have struck the tent, causing the crushing injuries and forcing the group to cut its way out of the tent and head to the forest for shelter. But there are a number of problems with this theory as well. For one, the slope where the tent was found was thought to be too shallow to suffer an avalanche. In fact, no avalanches were ever reported in that location before or after 1959. Plus, a normal avalanche wouldn't account for the massive internal injuries that occurred in some of the bodies. Most people who die in an avalanche suffocate from being buried in the snow. But none of the hikers suffocated. They either froze to death or were crushed by some powerful force. On top of that, an avalanche would have flattened the tent and surrounding trees. Yet there was no corresponding damage to the tree line, and photos of the site show ski poles still standing. You also have to consider that if an avalanche had crushed the hikers inside the tent, causing all the substantial injuries seen throughout the group, then how could the victims then manage to walk more than a mile away in a blizzard to the location where they would eventually be found? There were also no signs of anyone being dragged. Remember, there were 8 or 9 sets of evenly spaced footprints found leading away from the tent, meaning everyone walked away in a calm, orderly fashion. In 2013, author Donnie Eicher published a book titled Dead Mountain that proposed high winds passing over the mountains generated what is known as infrasound. These are vibrations that occur at a lower range than the human ear can detect, but are still able to generate a sensation of terror in the individual. Eicher's book is excellent in most details, and I highly recommend it. But one place I feel it doesn't hold up is with the infrasound theory. Whereas the effects of infrasound have been documented by scientists, it's only been shown to affect a small percentage of people. It seems unlikely that all 9 hikers would have been so terrified that they cut their way out of the tent, but then decided to walk at an orderly pace away from their only shelter. According to Eicher, once the group was further down the slope and away from the location where the infrasound winds were occurring, they managed to regain their composure. But now they were stuck at night in harsh weather, and they got lost. He suggests the traumatic injuries suffered by the 3 victims found down the slope occurred when they stumbled over the edge of a ravine in darkness and landed on the rocks at the bottom. Another theory suggests that the Monsi may have murdered the group or even poisoned them with some hallucinogenic substances that caused them to go on a bad trip leading to their deaths. This theory goes that the Monsi were angry with these interlopers invading their sacred lands, but this doesn't really hold up either. The Monsi provided valuable assistance in the search, and they even told the rescue party that the area wasn't sacred. Remember, they called the place Dead Mountain because there was no game there, and it was considered worthless to them. According to Sherlock Holmes, when you have eliminated all which has been possible, then whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth. Well, in the case of the Dyatlov Pass hikers, there is another more recent theory that offers the most likely explanation as to what really happened. In July 2020, a new investigation led by Andrei Kuryako, the deputy head of the Urals Federal District Directorate of the Prosecutor General's Office, concluded that the group had likely died as a result of an avalanche. This was further bolstered by science after a Swiss research team led by Johann Gohm of the Snow Avalanche Simulation Laboratory and Alexander Puzrin of ETH Zurich, a research university, published a paper in the journal Nature, concluded that a very specific type of avalanche was the likely cause of the tragedy. Gohm began to develop this theory after watching the Disney movie Frozen, and he observed the way that animators depicted slabs of snow sliding down the mountain. This got him thinking that something similar may have been responsible for what happened to the hikers at Dyatlov Pass. Gohm reached out to Disney's animators and used their code to create his own computer model of what he thinks likely happened. Gohm believes that when Igor Dyatlov and the other hikers set up camp on the mountain slope, they cut into a dense slab of snow, setting in motion a chain of events that led to tragic results. This particular hard pack of snow was very dense over top of a much softer and looser base. Gome's model showed that this heavy slab of snow would have gradually loosened over the course of several hours. This was likely aided by something known as katabatic winds. These are hurricane-force winds that can be generated in blizzard-like conditions, just like those that the hikers at Dyatlov Pass would have experienced that night. The computer model showed that this heavy slab of snow, which would have weighed in excess of 600 pounds, came loose as the hikers were laying down on their backs to sleep. This heavy and dense slab of ice and snow picked up speed as it came sliding down the mountain. The crushing weight of the snow would have damaged the tent and likely caused some or all of the devastating injuries seen in the hikers. Now, to be fair, the slab avalanche theory still doesn't account for all the weird stuff surrounding the deaths of the 9 hikers, such as the missing eyes and tongue. But taking this idea a few steps further, other researchers have put together a plausible timeline of events that may explain everything. Picture this. It's nighttime inside the tent. Wind outside is howling like a banshee. The hikers are cold and exhausted and hoping the storm will pass by morning. They all undress and settle in for the night, when suddenly they begin to hear some other terrifying sounds. At first, this would have sounded like a tremendous cracking noise, followed by a loud, thunderous rumble. Before the hikers even have time to react, the heavy slab of snow and ice smashes into the tent with the speed of a freight train, crushing down upon them and causing some of the serious injuries among their group. To the rescue party later on, this slab of snow is only a few meters deep and probably would have looked like natural snowfall. But to Igor Dyatlov and his friends, this creates an immediate and dire situation. The hikers are dazed and injured, and desperate to get out of the tent. Only the tent entrance is completely buried by snow. So they are forced to cut their way out of the tent, but they are now faced with a new set of challenges. Because it's freezing cold outside, they are all severely underdressed to survive in this weather. The problem is, most of their gear is still inside the tent, where they were unable to get to it. The solution? They have another cache of supplies they set up downhill inside the forest. Even though they are desperate, they know that any wrong moves at this point can prove fatal. So they have to do everything by the book. Instead of running away from the tent, they leave in an orderly line, trying to stay together. But this proves difficult in the dark, with the storm in full force all around them. The group heads down into the safety of the tree line and attempts to start a fire. Only the wood found at ground level is all icy and wet. So one of them climbs up a cedar tree in order to look for some drier wood. The problem is they were all racing against the clock, with temperatures in excess of 25 below zero, and some of them only dressed in their underwear. It's only a matter of minutes before they begin to die of hypothermia. Doroshenko and Krivanoshenko were the two dressed only in their skivvies. The burns found on their bodies probably came from them crouching too close to the fire they built. Only their skin was already so numb they probably didn't realize they were receiving third-degree burns. Krivanoshenko realized he was losing sensation in his extremities and bit a chunk of flesh off his hand in his delirium from the cold. Once the members of the group began to perish, the others are then forced to scavenge whatever clothing they can from their fallen comrades. Dyatlov, Kolmogorova, and Rustem Slobodin then try to make their way back to the tent, but the path ahead is slow and difficult in the blizzard, and soon the three of them die of hypothermia. Meanwhile, the remaining three hikers head further downhill and try to build a shelter. Only they encounter even more difficulty. They then make another deadly mistake by choosing a location beneath a fast-running stream that never freezes. This causes the roof of their shelter to collapse and sends them all hurtling down into a rocky stream bed where they are then buried face down under 13 feet of snow, which has come down upon them with a crushing force upon the rocks below. The missing eyes and tongue are likely the result of either scavenging animals or simply the result of decomposition from being face down in a running stream for 2 months. Although another possibility that I've never seen in any of the theories about this case is one that seems very plausible to me. And that's the possibility that Dubonina bit her own tongue off accidentally during the deadly fall under the rocks. If she did that, the tongue could have been washed away in the stream and never found again. Now, admittedly, this is all a lot of conjecture, but based on the known evidence, this is the one theory that manages to explain everything. Sure, it's fun to think of atomic yetis, UFOs, and KGB spy missions. But in truth, the most likely scenario is that the group fell prey to simple bad luck after making one poor decision of building their tent in the wrong location. Today, Dyatlov Pass has become a popular tourist destination. A memorial plaque in honor of the deceased hikers was erected on a large rock where the hikers once stopped and took photos near the pass. Yuri Yudin, the only member of the group who survived after his sciatica flared up early on, remained haunted by what happened to his friends right up until his death in 2013, at age 70. His dying wish was honored, and he was buried in the same cemetery, alongside the bodies of his comrades who died on Dyatlov Pass. The Conspirators is written and produced by me, Nate Hale, an entirely fictional identity. Thanks so much for listening. This episode was far and away my most popular listener request. I've had many of you ask me to cover the story of Dyatlov Pass over the years, but I have to admit I've always been reluctant because it's been talked about so much before. But I wanted to finally do this episode to clear up a lot of the myths and misconceptions surrounding these tragic events and try to tell you what I believe most likely happened to these brave individuals. I really hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did researching and writing it. In other business, I just wanted to remind you that if you'd like to hear even more content like this, then you can head over to my Patreon account, where if you sign up, you can get access to a substantial library of bonus mini-episodes. These are all short stories that aren't quite long enough to fill a full-length episode, but I still think are plenty interesting for listeners of the weird and mysterious like you and I. Patrons also get access to all sorts of other nifty bonuses, including stickers, magnets, t-shirts, and much more. If you're interested in becoming a patron to the show, then I'll put a link in the show notes. Another place you can find some new short-form content is over on my YouTube, TikTok, and Instagram accounts. I've been having a lot of fun making short videos to talk about the same sorts of topics you hear in this show. I'll put links to those in the show notes as well. Another great way you can help support us is to subscribe and give us a 5-star review wherever you get your podcasts. Currently we're on Apple, Spotify, and pretty much everywhere else as well. You can also check out our website, theconspiratorspodcast.com, to listen to our back catalog of shows. You can also follow us along on Twitter and our Facebook pages as well. I also encourage you to keep writing to me at any of those places or send me an email at theconspiratorspodcast@gmail.com and keep sending me episode suggestions. I have a growing list of which I just scratched off the number one suggestion with this episode. Thanks again for all your kind words and listener suggestions, and thanks to each and every one of you for joining me week after week. I hope you'll be back next time.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.